between earth and the lower regions was made, for the city had been built on Bab-Apsi, the gate of Apsu, Apsu being the name for the waters of chaos before creation. The same tradition is found among the Hebrews. The rock of the temple in Jerusalem reached deep into the Taom, the Hebrew equivalent of Apsu. To the degree that the efforts of a whole society were devoted instead toward the celebration of the ego of a given ruler or people, however, the construction of a ziggurat or pyramid could devolve pathologically into the worship of a false god, putting in the place of the functional and truly integrating divine ideal something proximate, self-serving, arrogant, power-mad, and prideful. A specific Babylonian construction, a massive stepped tower dedicated to the god Marduk, is often cited as the source of the idea for the Tower of Babel in the Bible, as Edward Lipinski, the Polish-Belgian biblical scholar, explains. The story of the Tower of Babel was perhaps inspired by the Etymenanche of Babylon, which was described by Herodotus and by Berossus, as well as by the Tower of Borsippa, the temple tower of the god Nebu. Etymenanche was constructed in the 6th century BCE by King Nebuchadnezzar II, a ruler who sought to rebuild the city of Babylon as a symbol of his power and authority. Insofar as this ziggurat was built to glorify Marduk, triumphantly emergent king of the gods, symbol of vision and the magic words of truth, as was apparently its purpose, it illustrated something approximating a monotheistic hierarchy. Insofar as its construction redounded to the glory of Nebuchadnezzar II, it was an expression of narcissistic presumption. The Tower of Babel story may also have been influenced by a corpus of Near Eastern myths featuring failed attempts to approach, breach, or storm the heavens, and appears strikingly similar to the Mesopotamian myth of Enmerkar and the Lord of Errata, which tells of a tower that is confounded by the gods. This tale, found in the Sumerian epic poem Enmerkar and the Lord of Errata, dating back to the 23rd century BCE, features a king who sought to establish his dominion over other cities and nations. He did so by building a towering structure that would reach the heavens, believing that this tower would serve as a symbol of his power and authority and would enable him to communicate with the gods. The Lord of Errata, a neighboring city, had his people build a higher edifice, believing that this would bring him even closer than King Enmerkar to the gods. The gods themselves, angered by the pride and arrogance of the two kings, confounded their language and scattered them across the earth, preventing them from completing their towers. It also appears that the account of the Tower of Babel was influenced by the political and religious rivalries between different Mesopotamian city-states. The prominent Dutch scholar Carol van der Toorn suggests that the story may reflect a polemic against Babylon and its ambitions in the southern Mesopotamian plain. The ancient Hebrews might certainly have had political reasons to choose the metaphor of Babylon as emblematic of the overweening pride of power-based empires, just as the city of Rome was chosen for such a role by the early Christians. This does not change the fact that the story of the Tower of Babel most fundamentally attempts to explore the nature and dangers of something deeper than the spirit of a single authoritarian culture, rather than being a critique of Babylon or any other empire. The narrative is not political, or if it is, it is so only in the service of a higher or deeper meaning. The same can be said of many of the biblical narratives that mention specific societies or even specific people. They are to be regarded as types or patterns with what is specific and identifiable, used only to characterize a deeper truth. How is that aim realized in the story at hand? The answer can be profitably approached from multiple vantage points. First, the terms Babel and Babylon are clearly related in terms of etymology and geography, derived as they arguably are from the Akkadian word Babylim, which means gate of the god. The name Babel, on the other hand, is related to the word Babylon, Babylim, but might have additionally been derived from or influenced by the Hebrew root Balal, meaning to confuse or to mix up. The connection between the terms Babylim and Babel is apparently a result of linguistic adaptation or borrowing over time. The Hebrew word Babel likely reflects the Semitic pronunciation of the Akkadian term Babylim. The biblical narrative connects the city of Babylon with the Tower of Babel, suggesting that Babylon was built on the same site where the tower was attempted to be built. The attempt to build the tower was a sign of human arrogance and rebellion against God. God punished the builders, as in the case of Enmerkar and the Lord of Arata, by making it impossible for them to understand one another and destroying the unity of their society. It can be seen from this etymology that Babel represents many things: empire and the presumption of empire, arrogance in tandem with technological might, the confusion that prevails when the aims of psyche and society have gone astray. Although the first builders of cities are the descendants of Cain, tradition has it that the city of Babylon specifically is founded by Nimrod, who does so in an act of God-defying hubris. Nimrod is a direct descendant of Noah's son Ham, who reveled in the sight of his father's nakedness and whose descendants were consequently cursed with failure and slavery. Genesis 9:20-27. Babylon is, therefore, not only the city of arrogant empire, but also the prototypical dwelling place of the son who lacks respect for his father, and who therefore places himself in a position of unearned moral superiority. Nimrod is described in the biblical text in terms reminiscent or indicative of those who seek power for power's sake, as the first on earth to be a mighty man, Genesis 10:8, English Standard Version, the first powerful man on earth, Holman Christian Standard Bible, or the world's first great conqueror, Good News Translation. Thus, the idea of overweening pride, might, and the lust for conquest is linked through the metaphor of his ancestry to the city-building technological enterprise, and more precisely, to the founding of the city Babylon. The story of the Tower of Babel is, in its essence, another retelling of the ever-present temptations and dangers of hubris, a warning against humanity's marked proclivity to arrogance and misguided ambition. It cautions against the temptations of the Luciferian intellect, the desire, manifest not least in Eve, Adam, and Cain, to exceed the proper human place, define good and evil themselves, and attain the heights. And by means other than identification with God and subordination to the intrinsic, pre-established, and eternal moral order. In building a tower that reaches to the heavens, the engineers and technicians of Babel or Babylon and their associated rulers and states aimed to make a name not for God, but for themselves. In their pride, they claimed divinity and overstepped the bounds that kept them properly ensconced within the true cosmic and metaphysical order. This all reflects the eternal alliance of the tyrannical spirit with the impetus toward intellectual and technical self-aggrandizement. The misguided and fatally presumptuous builders of the catastrophically unstable tower sought to obtain power over their environment, psychological, social, natural, and metaphysical, and to master it completely for narrowly self-centered reasons. It is instructive in this regard to understand that Cain, who invited the Luciferian spirit to dwell within him, is also explicitly described in the biblical text as the first to build a city, Genesis 4:17, in addition to being the forerunner of those who made various technological artifacts, including tents, Jabal, musical instruments, Jubal, and metal tools and weapons, Tubal-Cain, Genesis 4:21 22. It is thus that the engineers in general and the builders of the Tower of Babel, more specifically, are portrayed as Cain's spiritual descendants, taking pride in their creations and their mastery of the physical world, ignoring the spiritual hierarchy and the divinely ordained limitations. This disregard for the higher divine order inevitably produces a consequential disarray and chaos, as seen in the confusion of languages produced when the Tower of Babel collapses. The meaning of the story extends beyond its traditional and reductive understanding as a primitive theory about the origin of diverse tongues. The arrogant belief in the power of technology, and, more deeply, the presumption that the technical intellect can and should rule even over divinity, corrupts the entirety of psyche and state so completely that words themselves in such a state lose their meaning, a meaning that only exists if it is shared, that only exists in relationship to a universal point of reference. This disintegration emerges as even the implicit unity that lends words intelligibility is destroyed by the cascading consequences of the demolition of the proper order of understanding. This is exactly what is happening in our society now, a society increasingly unable to agree on the meaning of the most fundamental reference, the words man and woman foremost among them. Misdirection of aim destroys the purpose that brings people together in peaceful and productive competition and cooperation, and makes it impossible for each to understand what the other is doing. Words rely for their utility on their nesting within a framework of shared meaning. They must remain tools employed for the same task, chess pieces in the same game, as the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein so pertinently noted. This does not mean that the eternally lurking potential catastrophe of the Tower of Babel is an indication of the pathology of intellect and its striving per se. It is not an idiot invitation to a thoughtlessly and reactionary Ludditism. In its unadulterated and properly humble form, the intelligence that leads to technical mastery can and should be a stellar reflection of the Logos, a faculty well and appropriately regarded as the greatest gift bestowed by the Creator upon man. The presumptuous totalitarian catastrophe is instead the terrible consequences that inevitably emerge when the spirit of that intellect goes most direly and dreadfully wrong. This is why Lucifer, even Satan himself, was traditionally regarded, not least by Milton, as the highest but also most wayward angel in God's heavenly hierarchy. Brighter once amidst the host of angels than that star the stars among. that spirit of enlightenment, is the most valuable, imaginable, or possible faculty when it stays in its proper place, the true bringer of light, but the worst of all possible masters when it attempts to reign supreme. The development of civilization, intellect, and technology, progress in a word, is therefore not to be regarded as inherently sinful or evil. It becomes so only when it is held to be the supreme path forward, or worse, when the offering of that pathway is made in a manner that falsely elevates the perceived status of those making the offer. This is the attempt by the engineer or builder to be worshipped as the engine of creative progression itself in the attempt to impress and dominate, and when such attempts fail, to seek the revenge of the unjustly spurned. Echoes of Cain. This is no different than the attempt to usurp the throne of God himself, and is also a retelling of the central sin of man, as in the fall of Adam. There is no greater imaginable sin of pride. There is still more to this pattern of aberrant Babylonian conception and aim, although it is subtle, dreamlike, encapsulated only in poetic form, and prone to elude easy notice or understanding. To comprehend it fully, the more extended descriptions of Babylon and its inhabitants, male and female alike, must be considered. The abuse of technological power, as documented in the story of the Tower of Babel, might well and appropriately be regarded as a masculine proclivity. There is, however, a feminine counterpart. This is inevitable, as when things fall apart on the side of the male, there's bound to be a corresponding deterioration or perversion on the side of the female. Joined together as the two sexes ineluctably are in their development, attitudes, patterns of attention, and actions. How could the city, placing the worst possible spirit in the highest place, elevating the veritable and mysterious abomination of desolation, Daniel 9:27, Daniel 11:31, Daniel 12:11, Matthew 24:15, also therefore failed to be inhabited by the degenerates of the female world? How could it not open itself up to possession by the very spirit of that degeneration? The key to understanding the nature of the feminine descent into chaos in the biblical text is to be found in the identification of the common, uniting, and context-establishing theme of habitation in Babylon, the degenerate city that also happens to be the habitation of the matriarch of all whores. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Revelation 17, 4-5. It is all the people who inhabit the great but false edifice who become unable to communicate. After all, men and women with them. What happens when the patriarchal degenerates and loses its unity? When it cheapens itself and becomes sinful? The matriarchal loses its higher purposes as well, fracturing and regressing, making itself subject to the twin forces of power and hedonism that inevitably rise up when the God who properly reigns above dies, however temporarily. The whore of Babylon is the spirit that makes herself present, even worshipped. When women employ the power of sexual seductiveness as a tool of manipulation and advance and for the purposes of immediate hedonistic self-gratification, this the degeneration of femininity into commoditized sex is an inevitable consequence of moral failure on the masculine side, even though it is not something only to be laid at the feet of men. The proclivity for this to occur is an analog to the temptations of the Luciferian intellect. The immense sexual attractiveness of healthy, beautiful women is a gift or talent that, like intelligence, can go terribly wrong. This is much more likely to occur, of course, when the male community has abandoned its responsibility, not least to abide by the sacred dictates of monogamy, to substitute for that casual pleasure and worship of the power that makes such pleasure at least temporarily more available, albeit only to a few, however unsustainably and unreliably in the final analysis, even to them. This is not to understate the complicity of women. The temptation to flaunt and profit by what is attractive, regardless of consequences, future and social, is a clear and prominent hallmark of female manipulativeness and immaturity. The dark triad or tetrad traits described previously in relation to men predict also, for example, feminine proclivity to trade sex for desired resources, money most directly, or to avoid the productive and generative responsibility of marriage and motherhood. Considering the antithetical relationship, symbolically speaking, between the image of the Whore of Babylon and the traditional ideal of feminine nature aids in the further understanding of the degeneration of the state of pathological aim. That traditional ideal is, of course, the virgin and the child. A society that worships the former and forgoes the latter understands femininity only in terms of the undeniable raw sexual power of women, as the labor that women can provide insofar as they can substitute, however well or poorly for men, makes them not exactly women, but honorary men. A society that venerates the virgin, by contrast, elevates the status of women who voluntarily forgo manipulative and self-serving deployment of the power of their sexual attractiveness, one that extends this celebration to the sacred duo of woman and child, a truly mature attitude, orients itself to the long term, aiming at the stable communal relationships that best suit children and also most effectively and maturely satisfy the deepest needs of men and women, all things considered. What does all things considered mean in such a context? It means, in a manner that best ensures psychological integration and stability, in consequence of the continual dialogue and dance that characterizes a committed marriage. It means, in a manner that most thoroughly guarantees and stabilizes a productive, peaceful, and hospitable society, with committed couples serving that society as basic and necessary foundation. In all alternative arrangements, men and women drift, fall apart at the seams, and terribly. The understanding of femininity as relational, understanding of woman as inseparable in some fundamental sense from infant and therefore from husband, is a crucial element of a functional society. There is every reason to think that in the absence of such conceptualization, the psyches of both man and woman also fail to develop or disintegrate. Does this mean that single woman is a category of the undesirable? No more and no less than single man. Consider the following comments made by English clergyman and noted biblical scholar Charles John Ellicott, 1819 to 1905. Jeremiah 51:7, called Babylon, a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. The cup had made all the earth drunken, the cup of intoxication, splendid and attractive, was full of an evil power which robbed men's senses and degraded them. The great city of the world ever holds out such a glittering cup, which most do taste through fond intemperate desire. Soon as the potion works, their human countenance, the express resemblance of the gods, is changed into some brutish form. The brutish form referred to is the true identity lurking behind the mask of shallow sexual attractiveness monetized in the present world so often and in so many diverse forms, all produced, distributed, and purchased by the technological sons of Cain. The full domain of such sin and the all-encompassing span of its nature is revealed within the relevant texts as well in other complex manners. First is the association between Babylon and harlotry per se, which we have already alluded to, the denigration and exploitation of women by others and by themselves, particularly on the sexual front, is linked in the biblical corpus and then more explicitly by commentators with the rise of the prideful and technocratic spirit of Babel. This may well be something necessary to reflect upon in a time when technology has allied itself with prostitution in a manner so widespread and pervasive that it is a kind of perverse miracle. Some 25% of total web traffic involves the dissemination of pornographic material. This is certainly the technologically mediated subjugation of the feminine to the hedonistic and narrowly economic, and more deeply, the alliance of the prostitute, or her virtual equivalents, with the terrible spirit of arrogant irresponsibility characterizing the builders of the eternal Babylon. It was the possibility of broad access to pornographic material that was even one of the driving factors for both the development and widespread instantaneous and enthusiastic adoption of the World Wide Web. As Sigmund Freud so necessarily insisted, never underestimate the role sexual motivation plays in the determination of human behavior, no matter how apparently complex. It is relevant in this regard, and certainly not by chance, that it is precisely the engineers who are trying so desperately to literally build women, the very women who will not come to them voluntarily in reality because of their oft-parodied and essentially too narrow undesirability, magnified in repulsiveness by their appalling and resentful intellectual pride. It is also the engineers who have built the systems that bring the modern whores of Babylon and their delectable but untouchable succubus delights to the sticky laptops of the basement-dwelling techno-incels. Ellicott later comments in another relevant passage on Revelation 18:24. It is not by seductiveness only that her guilt is measured. Her hands are defiled with blood, the blood of prophets who had witnessed against her, of saints whose holy lives were a protest against her sins and so hateful to her. Babylon, the world city, is founded on those principles, the logical outcome of which is violence, bloodshed, and hostility to the highest right. Those who die by her hands, few or many, are the evidence that the whole tendency of her power is against holiness and truth. There are echoes here, too, of Christ's damning accusation against those who elevate themselves, parading false virtue while simultaneously transgressing against precisely the spirit they claim to embody. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Alternatively, go ahead and finish what your ancestors started. New International Version. Matthew 23:29-32. The sinners upbraided by Christ are those who have willingly broken the mysterious third commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Exodus 20:7. As discussed earlier, this commandment forbids the claiming of divine virtue or service to God when the pursuit in question is purely that of self-interest, forbids the subversion of what is highest to what is manipulatively cunning and instrumental. Just as the Pharisees transgress against the Spirit of God they have sworn to uphold, thereby killing that Spirit, or metaphorically, the prophets who bore its message, the ultimate harlot's actions violate the principles of the central uniting spirit so profoundly that the proper metaphor is one of drunken murderousness. This is a warning about the danger of the subjugation of sexuality to narrow economic self-interest and hedonic pleasure, and more broadly, another caution, more to the engineers or other prideful intellects, do not engage in the so often disdainful display of your intellect to attract the source of sexual pleasure, particularly of the short-term variety. Hint, it will seldom work anyway. Why else would men be driven to the sex bots designed to replace women, the very real women, who tend in their hypergamous choosiness to be utterly devastating to men's pride, who manage in that way to be the very agents of the acute self-consciousness that necessarily characterizes the most wayward, misaligned, and fallen of men. The rejection-predicated bitterness so engendered can and does drive men to murderousness, and far worse. The Tower of Babel is a structure that contains many chambers, each showcasing men and women in their worst light, precisely the light that shines forth so darkly in direct consequence of false worship. What is the full meaning of this complex web of associations? First, that the technological industrial enterprise itself can be driven by a false pride in mechanical mastery. Second, that such pride is likely to ally itself with the spirit of domination, conquest, and power. Third, that the subjugation of the feminine to, or the outright alliance of the corrupt feminine with that ally, is inevitable, and that such subjugation or willing participation also presents a profound psychological and social danger. Fourth, and even more deeply, that the whole Tower of Babel enterprise is associated with the kind of Luciferian pride that goes before the most profound and devastating of falls. It is for this reason that there are hints in the biblical corpus of the rebellion of Lucifer, a spirit characterized in the book of Job not only as an angel, but as a veritable son of God, and of a great and subsequent battle in heaven. This is the great theme lurking behind the temptation of Adam and Eve, and subsequently of Cain, of the hardening of the heart of the Pharaoh and the proclivity of the slavish Israelites to lose faith and rebel, of the torment of Job, and of the offering of the blandishments of the devil himself in the wilderness to the wandering and starving Christ. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Isaiah 14:12-14. The fall of the spirit of prideful, intellectual, technical presumption produces devastating psychological consequences, consequences that spill inevitably over into the social, the universal, and the eternal. Much has been made of these hints of schism in the divine realm. The great English poet John Milton made the elaboration of such ideas the main project of his life, taking pains to portray Lucifer as the highest angel in God's heavenly kingdom, gone, as we have seen, most terribly wrong, and the author of the hell he himself inhabits, along with his deluded followers, in consequence of his rebellion. It is for such purposes that Milton details the relationship or even identity of the spirit of Lucifer and the bringer of the deadly knowledge that doomed Eve and Adam in the Garden of Eden, associating that spirit as well with the prideful desire to supplant God. He trusted to have equaled the Most High, if he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God, raised impious war in heaven and battle proud with vain attempt. The consequence? The generation of hell as eternal dwelling place for Lucifer and his followers, defined as distance from what is unifying and transcendent, defined as the place of permanent terror, hopelessness, confusion, conflict, and misery. How can anyone read this great poem and not think of the arrogant aerial spirit that made itself so starkly manifest in the ideological catastrophes of the 20th century? Him, the almighty power, hurled headlong, flaming from the ethereal sky with hideous rune and combustion, down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. 9 times the space that measures day and night to mortal men, he, with his horrid crew, lay vanquished, rolling in the fiery gulf, confounded though immortal. But his doom reserved to him more wrath, for now the thought both of lost happiness and lasting pain torments him. Round he throws his baleful eyes that witnessed huge affliction and dismay, mixed with obdurate pride and steadfast hate. At once, as far as angels can, he views the dismal situation, waste and wild, a dungeon horrible, on all sides round as one great furnace flamed. Yet from those flames, no light, but rather darkness visible, served only to discover sights of woe, regions of sorrow, doleful shades, where peace and rest can never dwell, hope never comes that comes to all. But torture without end still urges, and a fiery deluge fed with ever-burning sulfur unconsumed. Such place eternal justice had prepared for those rebellious, here their prison ordained in utter darkness and their portion set as far removed from God and light of heaven as from the center thrice to the utmost pole. Lucifer means light bringer in Latin, shades of the Promethean deliverer of fire. The intellectual Luciferian thus delivers, or at least promises, a perverse form of enlightenment, a form that is a parody, in fact, of genuine or true enlightenment. Milton elaborates on the psychological consequences of the Luciferian attitude. Farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hail, horrors! Hail, infernal world, and thou profoundest hell! Receive thy new possessor, one who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven. The poet describes as well the motivation such a psychological state inevitably produces in relationship to social behavior and the broader world. To do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight, as being the contrary to his high will whom we resist. If then his providence out of our evil seek to bring forth good, our labor must be to pervert that end, and out of good still to find means of evil. Just as the resentful fratricidal impulse of Cain expands to include and then doom the whole world, the Luciferian impulse, manifest in the city of Babylon, dooms itself and all those who welcomed it to damnation and destruction. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and is become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Revelation 18:2-3. The knowledge contained in our dramas indicates at least our implicit or provisional understanding of this spirit of wounded and arrogant intellect. It is therefore truly a matter of question how much our inability to fully and explicitly understand it is a consequence of willful blindness instead of mere ignorance. The nature of this spirit of the damned is, after all, characterized exceptionally widely across literature and popular entertainment. The great German author Johann Wolfgang von Goethe's Faust perhaps provides the most famous early modern example, Faust 1808, Faust II 1832, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus 1818, featuring Victor Frankenstein as the avatar of the Luciferian intellect, made its appearance at about the same time. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, 1932, which came more than 100 years later and which still feels very modern, also weaves in themes of the corrupt feminine, in that sexual attitudes in Huxley's future dystopia are so lax that objection to casual promiscuity has become socially unacceptable. George Orwell's classic 1984, 1949, is perhaps the most famous 20th century literary example of the dystopian, Luciferian, Babylonian nightmare. Consider, in the same vein, the many dystopian movies of the past century. Metropolis, 1927, Blade Runner, 1982, RoboCop, 1987, Minority Report, 2002, Ex Machina, 2015, and, most explicitly and famously, in the Terminator series, which includes The Terminator, 1984, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, 1991, Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, 2003. Terminator Salvation, 2009. Terminator Genesis, 2015. Terminator Dark Fate, 2019. Remarkably enough, it is in some part demand for realistic portrayal of such apocalyptic Luciferian scenarios and parodies that drive the market for increased computational power. The laptops that we commonly use to perform relatively mundane tasks, such as word processing, spreadsheet manipulation, online video management, and internet search, do not require the vast calculating ability of the world's most advanced chips. Instead, it is the desire to produce ever more accurately rendered fictional worlds in game and movie form alike that provides a non-trivial portion of the economic incentive to keep that element of the current technological revolution alive and thriving. We use our most advanced machines to warn us, while entertaining us, of the danger of those self-same advanced machines. That, perhaps, is another evil joke. All of this, fact and fiction alike, is making itself manifest once again, as it has so continually in the past, in the unholy and all too real world alliance in still appallingly communist China between the ideologically possessed tyrants who rule that dismal wasteland and the engineers who labor there, striving naively toward ever greater heights of presumption and misguided prowess, all in delight of their own intellect, all instead of true devotion to what is properly highest. These are the orcs who inhabit the tower, raising the all-seeing eye of Sauron to the sky, who are, according to their own idiot savant testimony, building the Skynet that in its original fictional formulation waged war against the whole human race. That Skynet system, consisting now of some 700 million closed-circuit TV cameras, is apparently fast enough to scan every citizen of the People's Republic of China in less than a second and has an accuracy rate with regard to individual identification of more than 99%. The Chinese have also developed gate recognition systems that can identify individuals even when their faces are hidden or otherwise unavailable for view. Such overlap of name with the destructive cyborgs of Terminator fame is at minimum an evil joke, one reminiscent of the sign at the entrance of the death camp at Auschwitz featuring the slogan, Arbeit macht frei, work will make you free, or the acronym MAD, M-A-D, for Mutual Assured Destruction, which referred to a military strategy originating during the Cold War. MAD theorists touted the doctrine of rational deterrence, the belief that the certainty of mutual annihilation would produce a terror sufficient to maintain the peace among two heavily armed opponents, in this case, the Soviet Union and the United States and its nuclear-armed allies. Who would dare make such a joke? Only the most evil of clowns. That dark, parodying figure, closely allied with the Cain-like or Luciferian character, also features commonly and meaningfully in fiction, fantasy, and reality itself. Take, for example, the science fiction writer Ray Bradbury's Mr. Dark in Something Wicked This Way Comes, 1962. The head of a carnival traveling from town to town, he offers sinister delights to the naive and unsuspecting. Then there is the Joker character in the Batman series, someone sufficiently frightening even to set mafia dons back on their heels, which is also a theme particularly well-developed in The Dark Knight, 2008. See also Batman, 1989, Suicide Squad, 2016, and Joker, 2019. Stephen King's It, 1986, features Pennywise, an evil immortal clown. He is somehow a cosmic entity, or even a god, whose chosen dwelling place, the underworld, mythically speaking, is nonetheless the labyrinthine sewer system underlying the small town of Derry, Maine. TV versions, part 1 and 2, 1990. Movie version, part 1, 2017. Part 2, 2019. The mocking master of ceremonies of the Weimar Republic, extending an invitation of satanic hospitality to hedonist and Nazi alike, is the head clown of the piercingly accurate musical Cabaret, perhaps the most comprehensive reflection of the evil dance of our times offered in the last half a century. On the more ridiculous side, there are two characters from The Simpsons, Matt Groening's brilliant animated satire. Jeffrey Albertson, the comic book guy character, is best known for his caustic and demeaning intellectual manner, his complete and utter personal and social failure, his endless supply of pointless knowledge, and, most tellingly, his absolute willingness to criticize and dispose casually with everything of value. Worst comic book ever. Worst movie ever. Worst episode ever. Worst sequel ever. Worst crossover ever. And, most famously, worst sunset ever. The aptly named Sideshow Bob fleshes out the archetype. The pretentious Bob, like Kane, plays an eternally secondary role despite his narcissistic confidence and showy erudition, and turns bitterly to the contemplation of grandiose plots, all of which fail dismally as well as comically when tried out in the real world. A broadly similar role is played, surprisingly, by the figure of the Georgian-Russian tyrant, as well as each of his henchmen and hangers-on in their various ways, in Armando Iannucci's great black comedy film, The Death of Stalin, 2017, which is easy to imagine as a close approximation of the dark circus that the Soviet Union most truly constituted. The adversary of God is well understood as a parody of the divine. This is perhaps because there is no shortage of the truly ridiculous in the lies that people tilting toward totalitarianism so readily and self-destructively adopt. 5.2. Pride and the Fall. Reprise. Descent into Hell itself. Some brief consideration of the Greek myth of Daedalus and his son Icarus can aid us in further seeing the connection between overweening pride, particularly in the intellect, technology, and a fall, a descent from the heights, a collapse into chaos and confusion, a headlong plunge into the abyss, a dissolution into death. Daedalus, a skilled craftsman, was the architect of the labyrinth of Crete. King Minos, ruler of Crete, imprisoned Daedalus and his son within the architect's own creation. While trapped within the maze, Daedalus used wax and feathers to construct wings for himself and Icarus so they could take to the skies and escape. As they soared above Crete, Icarus, enthralled by the exhilaration of flight, disregarded his father's warning not to raise himself too high in the heavens. But Icarus flew ever upward, ever closer to the sun and to his fate. The heat melts the wax that held his wings together, so that he plummets into the sea and drowns. It is tempting to employ technological solutions to the labyrinthine problems of life and to rise in the world as a result. But hubris and the imprudent celebration of technology can make of those solutions an even worse problem. A warning to the engineers: do not presume to fly so high that God himself feels the necessity to intervene. The stories of the biblical corpus repeatedly insist, likewise, that pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 16:18. They also detail the inevitable allyship between arrogance and the proclivity to use force and compel. The expansive poetic portrayals of the causal relationship between the Luciferian spirit and Babylon's rise and fall reflect many aspects of that ultimately doomed alliance, as intimated by Isaiah 14:12. How art thou fallen from heaven? The 18th century biblical scholar John Gill comments with regard to such disintegrations and descents: this is not to be understood of the fall of Satan and the apostate angels from their first estate when they were cast down from heaven to hell, though there may be an allusion to it. But the words are a continuation of the speech of the dead to the king of Babylon, wondering at it as a thing almost incredible, that he who seemed to be so established on the throne of his kingdom, which was his heaven, that he should be deposed or fall from it. So the destruction of the Roman pagan emperors is signified by the casting out of the dragon and his angels from heaven, Revelation 12:7. And in like manner, Rome papal, or the Romish Antichrist, will fall from his heaven of outward splendor and happiness, of honor and authority, now possessed by him, O Lucifer, son of the morning, alluding to the star Venus, which is the phosphorus or morning star, which ushers in the light of the morning and shows that day is at hand, by which is meant not Satan, who is never in Scripture called Lucifer, though he was once an angel of light and sometimes transforms himself into one, and the good angels are called morning stars, Job 38:7, and such he and his angels once were. But the king of Babylon is intended, whose royal glory and majesty, as outshining all the rest of the kings of the earth, is expressed by those names, and which perhaps were such as he took himself or were given him by his courtiers. Violent demise is all too often and predictably the natural end of the tyrant, the ultimately personal consequence of the collapse of the Tower of Babel state. This is so fundamentally and basically true that it even appears to apply in the case of chimpanzees, who are our closest natural relatives. Chimpanzees are characterized by the rule of something approximating a true patriarchy. Although females can and do occupy positions of substantive authority, all chimp troops have a male at the absolute head. In his book, Chimpanzee Politics, the influential and intellectually wide-ranging Dutch primatologist Frans de Waal describes how chimp leaders, who rely on aggression and intimidation to maintain their power, inevitably face dangerous challenge from subordinates who come to resent their tactics. He illustrates this principle with the story of the violent overthrow of a dominant male chimp named Jeroen, several years ruler of the troop at the Royal Burgers Zoo in Arnhem, Netherlands. When Jeroen became increasingly aggressive and unstable, his subordinates began to join together against him. Jeroen was attacked by his coalition partners, who clearly intended to kill him. The struggle that ensued was intense and brutal, with blood and hair flying, until finally Jeroen lay motionless on the ground. He had suffered a fatal wound to the neck and never regained consciousness. In another case, a former alpha male called Luet was caught by the new alpha, Amos, and his coalition. Luet was completely overpowered and never recovered from his wounds. He died shortly afterward. In other cases, deposed males are castrated or chased away. De Waal notes that chimp leaders who by contrast rely on strategies of mutually beneficial reciprocation, have longer reigns and more stable, pacific, and productive social groups. The most successful individuals are not necessarily the strongest or most aggressive, but rather those who are best at managing relationships. He states elsewhere that the human capacity for empathy and cooperation may well have evolved from the cooperative tendencies of our primate ancestors, chimpanzees and bonobos. That is a remarkable statement of biological fact, given the contemporary prevalence of the belief that even human social structures are at all levels best understood as manifestations of, first, nothing but social conditioning, and second, nothing but the will and ability to use power, force, and compulsion. Consideration of the terrible fate awaiting chimp dictators might well give pause to those who lay claim to the desirability and utility of power as a unifying force. But if it fails to convince, there are also the salutary examples of once mighty rulers such as Benito Mussolini and Nicolas Ceausescu. In the closing days of World War II in Europe, Mussolini and his mistress, Clarita Petacci, fled Milan, where they had been based, and headed toward the Swiss border. They were captured in the small village of Giolina di Mezzagra in northern Italy on April 27, 1945, and shot by Italian partisans the next afternoon, 2 days before Adolf Hitler's suicide in Berlin. Their bodies were returned to Milan and left in the Piazzale Loreto, a suburban square, for a large, angry crowd to insult and desecrate. They were then hung upside down from a metal girder above a service station on the square. A similar fate befell Nicolae Ceausescu, the communist dictator of Romania, who had become increasingly repressive during the almost 25 years of his rule, imposing strict economic controls that led to widespread shortages of food and other goods, and cracking down on dissent, imprisoning or killing thousands of his opponents. In December 1989, protests against his regime erupted in the city of Timișoara, spreading quickly to other parts of Romania. Ceausescu, forced to flee Bucharest, the capital, was captured a few days later, put on trial by a hastily convened military tribunal, and found guilty of genocide and other crimes against humanity. He and his wife, Elena, were executed in a military base outside Bucharest on Christmas Day. The execution was broadcast live on television, and it was watched by millions of people worldwide. The moral of such stories? The fall from totalitarian heights is likely to be as total as the initial presumptions of the failed state. Furthermore, the collapse of the Tower of Babel is something personal and psychological as much as social. There are echoes of the conflict between the more peaceful and therefore more successful and more truly alpha male and his power-obsessed and therefore genuinely, although not obviously weaker opponent, contained within the biblical corpus. In the story of David and Goliath, for example, it is David, the young shepherd, who defeats the giant Philistine warrior Goliath with a single stone from his sling. The Philistine army is set against its Israelite equivalent in the broader context of the story. Single man-to-man combat is proposed, the Philistine champion against the champion of the ancient Hebrews, as a means of concluding the conflict, with the defeated party's countrymen to serve as the slaves of the victor. Goliath was a terrifying physical specimen. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had an helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of his coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. 1 Samuel 17:5 to 17. No Israelite was willing to engage this giant in battle until David, laughably less impressive than his erstwhile opponent, makes his appearance. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. 1 Samuel 17:41 to 44. But David, in his job as caretaker of the vulnerable, had become thoroughly accustomed to dealing with ferocious predators, as he informed Saul, the king, who nonetheless doubted his champion's ability. And Saul said to David, Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. And David said unto Saul, Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. 1 Samuel 17:33 to 36. The famous story closes with the defeat of the arrogant giant, the subjugation of the Philistines, and the victory of the forces of Israel. And it came to pass, when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slang it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. 1 Samuel 17:48 to 51. The moral of the story? The true hero is he who defeats the giant tyrant of the state. Similar tales of heroes and tyrants are universally present in the folklore of mankind. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, the hero Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu defeat Humbaba, a giant guardian of the cedar forest. After slaying Humbaba, Gilgamesh uses his body to build the gates of the city of Uruk. The Norse god Thor similarly battles a number of giants, including Jotunheim's king, Thrym, who steals Thor's hammer. Thor kills him in consequence and retrieves his magic tool. In the classic Chinese novel, Journey to the West, Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, battles the demon Bull King, who is causing chaos in the underworld. Sun Wukong kills the demon and saves the day. This story parallels the classic Greek myth of Theseus and the Minotaur. Theseus, the legendary founder king of Athens, defeats the monstrous Minotaur, a half-man, half-bull creature, and then uses a ball of string to find his way out of the labyrinth where the creature was imprisoned. These narratives portray the battle between two spirits, the spirit characterized as upward-aiming, dedicated to all good things, and striving forward on the side of the truth, and the spirit of Luciferian intellect and pride, prone to worship technology, willing to use compulsion, force, and power, liable to degenerate into hedonistic promiscuity, manifesting itself inevitably in the form of dark parody and the blackest comedy imaginable. The latter spirit serves chaos, is the precursor to or agent of chaos, wishes in some fundamental sense to rule over chaos. It can be understood both as the tyrannical state, the state where everyone lies, or as the pattern of resentful and deceitful worship, attention, and action that brings about the tyrannical state. That state, that kingdom turned to stone, is the evil brother of the once great king, whose willful blindness enables the eternal usurper. The personality of Cain is the force animating that evil brother, just as the descendants of Cain are those who erect the doomed tower. The giant overthrown by the hero is the degenerate state. That pattern of overthrowing is a variant of the battle between order and chaos that constitutes creation itself, not least in that the rise of the evil state is precursor to the return of that pre-cosmogonic potentiality. God portrays himself as precisely this victorious force in his presentation to the long-suffering Job. "Behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force is in the navel of his belly. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him." Job 40:15-19. Speaking the truth that redeems to the authoritarian and wrestling with possibility so that the order that is good or even very good can be established or reestablished, this is the work, the sacrifice of God, and the responsibility, obligation, and adventure of all those made in his image. God, in the story of the Tower of Babel, is the transcendent being who is the absolute antithesis of presumptuous authority, just as he was when warning Adam and Eve against eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. He is the being who eternally warns, "Do not replace me with the worship of your own pride and power, because all hell is bound to break loose if you do." God is therefore reliably portrayed as what must be placed properly atop both the psychological and social hierarchy, what is signified properly by the gold cap at the pinnacle of the pyramid, what serves as the proper all-seeing eye or sage on the mountaintop, lest everything disintegrate, including, not least, the ability to see and speak. This is the God who manifests himself in the human willingness to engage in the productive, upward-aiming dialogue, negotiation, and communication that provisions and stabilizes the psyche and the community alike. In this manner, we reflect the image of our Maker, bringing order to the world, or reestablishing that order when it has been violated and corrupted. What is the alternative? The rise of arrogant pride and presumption, the erection of grandiose monuments to the falsest of gods, the invocation to the whore, the disappearance of the shared assumptions on which understanding itself rests, and the collapse of everything into a state indistinguishable from hell. So speaks wisdom from time immemorial. 5.3. Inability to understand one another. Our capacity to communicate is mysterious. Why can we understand one another at all, even in principle, given that we are separate, autonomous, and independent creatures? It is partly because we are very similar in our material natures, biologically and developmentally speaking. Our fundamental or basic psychophysiological structures are nearly identical on a person-to-person basis. That similarity extends far down the phylogenetic or evolutionary hierarchy. We also share much in common with the non-human creatures with whom we share the garden. The fact of the very axioms that God does not allow human beings to question when he warns against incorporation of the final knowledge of good and evil represented by the forbidden fruit is a consequence, not least, of this shared psychophysiological identity. It is such commonality that enables our understanding, not only of other human beings, but also of animals. And most truly, to the degree that any animal is genetically and therefore psychologically and physically similar to us, shared culture, and that means shared procedure, imagination, and explicit semantically mediated knowledge, both fiction and fact, of course, increases that similarity. So it is easier for us to understand other people who share the same tradition, who dream similar dreams, and who speak the same language. All these similarities allow us to start our conversational or communicative efforts with the same assumptions, to ground the words we exchange in the same background of imagination and the same practice of attention and action. This gives us ground to stand on while we speak. If we had to talk about everything, that ground would rapidly turn into sand. We would fall otherwise.